Hey, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Over the Cap podcast. It's August 8th, 2021. This is Jason Fitzgerald. You can find me on Twitter at Jason_OTC or at overthecap.com. Was going to record this last night. I was a little bit tired, and as you can hear, my voice is kind of hoarse as well. So I ended up holding off on it until Sunday morning here. And I was going to actually record this a little bit earlier, and as things turned out, I guess it was good that I didn't, because there was a lot of NFL news that broke this morning. So I guess that's where we'll start out today, is just kind of talking a little bit about some of the various contract news in the NFL, then get a little bit into just a basic salary cap discussion. As always, Nelly is here with me. Nelly, you got anything? No? Okay. So nothing again from Nelly. We'll see if she pops in. And the kids are running around upstairs, so there's always a chance of a guest appearance of the kids, I'm sure, too. So I guess one of the things that I wanted to mention right off the bat, just a little bit here, is I am starting to do a couple of videos on YouTube now. It's just kind of new for me to do them this way. And this just kind of, I don't know, it goes with what a lot of people have been saying about being able to visualize stuff. So if you want to check that out as well and subscribe to that, you can do a search for Over the Cap or click on any of the videos that you see on the OTC front page that might pop up there in the timeline of articles, and you can pop over and take a look at them. I still got to figure out the format that we're going to do for these and the best way to do them, you know, just to see if people want to engage through the video medium a little bit more so than just the podcast or writing. I know writing is one of those things where people have time for it. They'll read it, they'll glance it. But a lot of stuff nowadays seems to be consumed much more audio, video kind of things. And so you can check that out. And I'll mention that here when we talk about Josh Allen in a second too. But you could subscribe to that channel if you want. Give me some ideas for some things that you guys might want to see on there. I was thinking as well, doing either like a YouTube live or something through one of the Twitter spaces or something like that, where instead of doing the kind of Q&A stuff that I do on Twitter, I could at least put a little video to it, whether it's a shared screen or just a video of me talking, and we can kind of do the questions in real time a little bit, you know, whenever I do those. That probably won't be until the fall, but you can let me know what you guys might prefer for that, and we could see where we go with that. So anyway, on to the news, the contract news. The big contract news of the week was Josh Allen. Now, we have a detailed video breakdown on that one on Twitter, on YouTube, so you can check out the more detailed analysis there. And I'll just kind of hit on some of the things. I was very surprised that Allen took a deal that was 6 years in length. This ties him to the Buffalo Bills for 8 years. It's a really long contract. It's the second longest contract among quarterbacks, the tops being Patrick Mahomes. That was a 12-year deal, 10 new years. This contract is much, much stronger for Josh Allen than the Patrick Mahomes deal is for Patrick Mahomes. That one is much more friendly for Kansas City. This one is much better for Josh Allen. But I was very surprised that he did a 6-year deal. The whole concept of this contract, in a sense, it's kind of backwards from everything that I would have expected. To me, the very risk-averse party in this was Josh Allen. This is a contract that is designed to protect him from catastrophic disaster, basically. This contract for him is very good if Josh Allen turns into a pumpkin this year. So if Allen goes and kind of reverts back to what he was as a rookie and a second-year player, he's protected for a pretty long period of time. If he plays at a reasonably high level, now I'm not saying he's got to compete for an MVP the way that he did last year, but if he plays at a reasonably high level, the benefits on this deal pretty much all lie with Buffalo. So the deal averages $43 million a year. The cap charges should be, give or take a little bit, about $10.3 million this year, $16.38 in 2022, $39.8 in 2023, $41.8 in 2024, $51.3 in 2025, just under $47 million in 2026, $40 million in 2027, $41.6 million in 2028. This is a deal that will be very good for Buffalo if he ends up being that kind of quality player. You know, I know that the numbers, like with the Mahomes deal, can be eye-popping. We're like, God, $43 million, $45 million. These numbers are going to be obsolete a couple of years from now. I'm very surprised that there are people who are thinking that this is a really, really good contract in terms of the annual values and stuff like that because of the guarantee structure. Really kind of surprised by that. The way the market runs, short-term deals are the way to go for the quarterback position if you're looking to maximize your value. Now, I know a lot of people don't think that way. It's, you know, the money is so big. It's like, well, you know, how much do you need? And I know I've talked about that before, that that's one of the reasons why other players get franchise tagged, because quarterbacks never get to market. They never get close to being to market. So the franchise tag is never hung up on the quarterback position. So basically, you end up with all these deals where the players get extended on them. But when you look at the history of the position, and I know Wentz and Goff were swings and a miss. And I know I mentioned before, and if you're a premium subscriber and you read the quarterback piece we did in there, you could see that teams have been too risky at the quarterback position, I think, in the last couple of years. The prices in general go up, and the players typically are playing until their mid-30s. So you want to optimize the amount of money you can make by getting to three contracts. And this type of structure probably doesn't get you there. Now, you can fix this in the second contract, you know, that he would do, or third contract, however you want to, whatever you want to call it, a second veteran contract. So you can fix it. But for the most part, this probably lines him up for two mega deals. Whereas someone like a Dak Prescott got three. You know, there's a reason why Kirk Cousins is the highest paid player in the NFL over like the last 5 years or so. It's because he just kept going big money, big money, big money, restructure, big money. That's really the better way to go if you're looking to maximize your earning potential. In terms of risk, the risk on this deal, though, is taken on much more by Buffalo. You know, I kind of figured it would have been the other way around. I thought that they would have gone for the short. I thought that Allen's group would have gotten a shorter deal. I thought he would have gotten more money up front. And he got good cash flows on this. It's not like he didn't. You know, he basically sets a high watermark in every single metric except for the first year. He trails Dak Prescott, and I think he trails Russell Wilson. So that's the only spot where he doesn't really hit that. So, you know, this is like a record-setting contract for 2 year cash, 3 year cash, 4 year cash, unlike Mahomes, which didn't set a record at any point in time. And you can also make an argument that this is worth more than the Mahomes deal, because his 6 year cash payout is actually higher than Mahomes' 6 year cash payout. Anyway, you know, I figured, though, that's what it would have been. You know, you would have been looking at $41, $42 million a year, 4 year deal, a lot of money up front, you know, a lot of protection, basically three of the first 4 years guaranteed kind of stuff. And away you go after that. You know, then you looked for another contract and then another one after that. Buffalo instead gets the longer term deal, but they do take on a lot of risk. So what they did here is they followed the vesting structure of the Mahomes deal. And you can, that one you can check out the video on, but the short gist of it is that he's basically protected in that contract through at least, I would say, the 2025 season. There really are not many outs in this contract because of the salary cap implications and the guaranteed salary mechanisms that jump in the deal. Basically, what'll happen is if he's on the roster on like the fifth day or the third day, I think it's fifth day of the league year, the salary the following year will become guaranteed, fifth day of the league year. So if he's on the roster on the fifth day of like the 2024 league year, you know, his 2025 salary becomes guaranteed. And he might even get a partial on 2026. So it's a favorable schedule in terms of that. So they would have to pay a lot of money to move him. So it's not like Wentz, it's not like Goff. If he flames out, this is a very difficult contract to cut, and it's a near impossible contract to trade, because if he flames out, who's going to want to trade for this kind of contract? Because you're looking at big salaries. You know, the even though the bonuses in this are huge, you'd still be looking at salaries, just as an example, on the last on the extension years of the deal. Let's look at what those would be real quick, just to see for trade purposes. Yeah, you know, you'd be at $37 million. So, or $36.3 million, sorry, not 37. So $36.3 million, even if we project that 3 years from now, that's still a pretty high number if you're Buffalo, because this guy would have to be a disaster. Imagine if he played like Wentz did last year, and then trying to find a trade partner that's willing to pay $36.3 for him versus, you know, Wentz is like a 25, 26, 27. Whereas Wentz is, you know, a year and a half guaranteed, and this guy would just have rolling guarantees throughout. I look at the contract as basically untradeable. Now, if you get into the June 1 mechanisms on this, I guess you could make an argument that you could, if he was a real mess up. Basically, everybody's going to get fired if he would be this kind of mess up. But if he was the type of mess up that was the equivalent of Carson Wentz, you know, and Goff, where they don't even make it to the extension year, which in his case would be 2023, you probably could June 1 him in 2023. If you June 1 in 2023, the cap hit would go from 39.78, which is what you would hold on there. And that's, it would rise to, because you would get, you'd have the guarantee from the next year kick forward. It'd be 45.28 million dead. You'd have to cut him a check for 33.5 there. I'm sure there's an offset on that. So if he signed somewhere else for eight, you know, you'd get a little bit of an offset. You'd defer 32 million to the next year. So, I mean, you're looking at a huge number, you know, 87 million basically in dead money. I mean, it's ridiculously huge. I'm sorry, it's not. Is it 87? I might have missed the number in there. Hold on one second. Let me cross check that. Yeah, it would actually be higher. There's another 10 million partial that's in there. I missed that one. Let me see. Where did I miss that? 10 million on the 2024. So it would actually be 55.28 dead, with a check of 43 million that you'd be paying to him, and then you'd defer 32. So that's like a pseudo escape point. Probably not going to happen at any reasonable juncture. Legitimately, your escape point is 2026, where you could walk away with about 24 dead, you know, on the deal. And you would have paid him at that point $180 million, 152 new. So basically, the contract would average out to $51 million a year for 3 years of play if you had to cut him at that point. So basically, that's why I say the risk is on Buffalo, because if you're talking about cutting him after 3 years, that means you paid him $50 million a year. It's a crazy, crazy, crazy number, you know, and so that's where that insurance is for him. And that's probably why they did the deal. But it's a very backwards thing. I would have expected Buffalo to be a little bit more risk averse here. And I would have expected the agents to look for more real money within this deal and get him back to free agency. So, you know, if he plays out to that end of contract where you're at $43 million a year, you know, that ends up being a very good deal for Buffalo. So if he's the real deal and he plays this contract out, like you would expect a quarterback to do that you extend, there's a steal for the Buffalo Bills. If not, then, you know, he did a good job of completely protecting the downside, because I think the downside with Allen is it's certainly much higher than it was with Mahomes, where you knew Mahomes was the only thing that was going to stop Mahomes was injury. With Allen, you don't know. Now, I'm sure Buffalo knows better than most, but it is still something that you don't know about. So anyway, you can check out the more detailed breakdown of how the dead money works in that thing on the video. So the next big deal that came down actually comes down this morning, and that's Darius Leonard. Darius Leonard signs a deal that sounds like it's going to be 97 over 5. So it's a really big contract. He's going to set the high watermark for a number of different key metrics that we typically look at. So he's going to top Fred Warner's deal. Warner averaged $19 million a year. This is going to be a little bit higher than that. This one also carries a bigger max value where he can get to 99.25. So he's going to jump that one. He's got 52.5 in injury protection. That's the tops in the NFL. That actually beats the CJ Mosley deal. I think that's probably the most impressive part about this contract. You know, Warner's at a 40.5, Wagner was at 40.3, and they weren't able to touch the Mosley deal, so they were able to jump the Mosley contract. That's a big move. Now, I know a lot of times the guarantees don't mean anything, but at least on paper, I think that's a pretty big move. He's got 33 guaranteed in total. I'm sorry, up front at signing. That's also a pretty big number there. Warner was at 27.5. They're basically coming off the same exact location. You know, both, I think, at 3.384 on their P5s on their old contract. So that was pretty solid as well. So he's going to be the first player over $30 million, not named CJ Mosley. So that's a pretty impressive number there as well. Signing bonus is $20 million on the deal. That's also tops at the position. So again, those are all like kind of cool things that you look for. I don't don't know what his first year cash number is. My assumption is it will also be tops in the league. Top player right now is at 26. So we already know that he's got 20. And based on the fact that he does have a 33 full, my assumption, and my assumption could be wrong, a 33 full would indicate a $10 million salary next year, which would mean $30 million new in first-year money. That's also really big. The three-year cash, it looks like he'll also be tops. That looks like it's about 59. The question is just how much of a disparity it is from Warner. Warner has a unique mechanism in his contract, which basically is a option bonus that is due after the year ends. It's a buyback bonus. So technically, that does fit into the cash from that year the way the NFL accounts for it. That's how we have it in there right now. I'm trying to get a little more clarification on that one just to see if we should be including him as like a 56-ish three-year or 58. My assumption is that we're coming in here with Leonard at 59.25. Could be a little bit less than that. Could be 58.5. But basically sets the legitimate high water mark for 3 year. So we'll hopefully get that full breakdown afterwards. But, you know, huge contract for him. So that's a really nice contract, really nice deal. He's got per game bonuses in there. They're less than Warner's bonuses by a little bit. But, you know, it's a solid contract. Other one that came down. So two, I'll talk about Nick Chubb afterwards, just because maybe I'll work that into the little discussion that I wanted to have today before all this stuff came down. The other one was Xavien Howard. And okay, so they basically did all the kind of stuff that we talked about as to ways that you can kind of bridge a gap when you have a contract meltdown where the player's unhappy. Now, they wanted to take money and move it from the last year of the contract where money's never going to get earned and move it forward. That didn't fly with Miami. Miami instead goes for the adding in incentives into the contract. So Miami adds in there $1 million if he makes the Pro Bowl again or if he's all pro. He's got a decent chance, I would say, of earning that because as long as he's healthy, he was so much in the news cycle this year that he's probably going to get a lot of attention for his play. So as long as his play is decent, doesn't even have to be great, he'll probably go to the Pro Bowl again. 70% play time, he gets 750. 80% play time, 750. 90% play time, he gets $1 million. So the 91 is a little bit harder. I'd say that's like a 50-50 chance. The other two are probably pretty likely to be earned. They have a tag on there where, you know, basically there's got to be some kind of improvement for the team, I guess, in some pretty crappy categories that are there. I would expect he'll probably earn a portion of that unless he's injured. You know, if he gets hurt again, then you don't earn any of this. Apparently, there's assurances that they'll renegotiate next year. Every time I hear that, I always say that the two sides interpret that completely different. The Jets used to get this all the time. We see teams get that constantly. You know, they'll say that the player will say that they were promised something. And in reality, it's not that. You know, that Miami may very much mean we'll renegotiate with you next year to market, meaning we'll throw incentives in the deal once again to bring your value up to $16 million. That's what you want. That's what we'll do. They will probably interpret it as they're going to rip up this contract and give us a brand new contract that brings us close to $17, $18, $19, $20 million a year for the next 5 years. Two very, very, very different approaches. Howard's cap number will probably increase by about $2 million this year. They included the 17th game check in his salary. It didn't sound like they did that in the future, which is kind of weird. So I'm just wondering if people didn't report that properly, because if you got that right for this year, you should get it right for all the years of the deal. Unless, again, they're thinking that this is going to be part of the assurance process of being renegotiated. But that's pretty easy to put on paper. So I'm not sure on that one. And, oh, you know, circling back to Josh Allen, that's another thing. His contract actually is a little under 43 in real value because they did not take into account, it seems like, anything to do with 17th game check. Now, maybe before the deal is final, you know, before they signed off, maybe they picked up on it. But it did not sound as if he got the extra money that was coming his way for a 17th game, which is actually pretty significant because his option year salary was pretty high. I think it was around 23. If they didn't do that, he sacrificed, let's see how much, you know, about $1.4 million So, I mean, that's a pretty big number there. So hopefully they didn't do that here. They also guaranteed Howard's salaries next year. Prior to this, half of it was guaranteed for injury. Now half is guaranteed for injury. Half is fully guaranteed. The rest will become fully guaranteed next March. That's like on paper stuff. You know, it's something. It gives you protection. It gives you peace of mind. But in reality, how bad would Howard have had to have been this year to get cut next year? You know, that's the reality. So sometimes when we look at these things, we look at them from the perspective of what sounds awesome to get reported by insert big name here, you know, on Twitter to get, you know, all these hits, all these pops, all this stuff versus does it really mean anything? You know, again, it's better to have it than not to have it, but it's not like it was a huge deal. So anyway, I was, when the news first came out and it was reported that he got new money in the deal, I said, wow. You know, that's stunning. And then when the details came out, it's like, okay, this is exactly the way teams have been dealing with this situation for ages. You know, Gilmore with the Patriots, right? He put incentives in there. Brady with the Patriots, incentives. Antonio Brown with the Steelers, incentives. You know, all these players, Gronkowski with the Patriots, add incentives. Hunter with the Vikings, add in the potential voids and kickers and stuff. You know, this has been a way that teams have done this for a very long time. So I don't think any of this was really out of the ordinary, nor was it unexpected. I just don't know why it took this long to get there. This should have happened months ago rather than, you know, getting to the point where he was kind of going through the motions at practice. It's like, well, why go through that when this is going to be done before? When you realize that strategy A is not working, one of the two sides has got to come up with strategy B to make it work. Now, I don't know which is the one that came up with this, but whatever one it is, it should have been done a long time ago. So yeah, that was the take on that. And then the other one is Nick Chubb does a deal. So Nick Chubb's deal is going to average about $12 million a year. And you know, let me pull it up. Let's pull up the actual numbers here. Okay, let's see. So Nick Chubb is going to average $12.2 million a year, $20 million injury protection, 17 full. It's $20 million guaranteed, basically. 12 to sign, 13.55 in first-year cash, 36.6 over three. These are all good numbers, you know, for him. Blows away past the Aaron Jones deal, a little bit behind the Derrick Henry deal. This is a much shorter contract. It's only 3 years. For running backs, a lot of that doesn't matter. You know, you're lucky if you can make it through those 3 years. I mean, you really beat in the system. So, I mean, it's good. It's probably not as big of a deal, I guess, as some would make of it. You know, but it's better than being locked in for 4 or 5, you know, unless you're going to have that Alvin Kamara giant kicker at the end of it. There are people all over the map on this contract, and I'm not really sure why people are all over the map on it. Number one, it's not a bad contract. I have no idea where the thought is that this was like a bad deal for Chubb. Like, I have no idea where that came from. Like, in what universe is any team in the league going to sign Nick Chubb to a 5-year deal with $50 million in guarantees? I mean, it's not going to happen. There's only one contract in the league at the position anymore that has that kind of guarantee in it. That's the Ezekiel Elliott deal. Look, the running back deals exploded with Todd Gurley. All right, it hit a trigger point. Gurley got done, and because of Gurley, the Cardinals were willing to move on David Johnson. They were not going to move on David Johnson until somebody else did that. So they moved on him, and then that led to Zeke getting the deal that's 15 a year with 50 million injury protection, 28 million full, and like a very favorable vesting schedule to protect him in his contract. Christian McCaffrey got to 16, you know, and Le'Veon Bell got to whatever he did. But even McCaffrey's guarantee is they're at 36 and 30, 36 injury, 30 full. So I don't know where the thought was that he was going to get there. Look at the players who have signed after this, because the feeling was these were all a mistake. So you have Alvin Kamara at 15, but Alvin Kamara's 15 is more like a 13. All right. Now, I'm not going to run through the actual numbers here to get that actual total. He's got 34 total guaranteed, 17 full. They threw a giant balloon payment to get that deal done because they needed to get him to 15 a year to make him sign. Dalvin Cook, explosive player, $12.6 million a year, 28 total, 16-fold. Derrick Henry. Derrick Henry is probably the closest comparison to Nick Chubb. You know, it's your guy who's like a closer running back, someone who has been dominant kind of at end-of-game situations where you're kind of playing keep away. 12-5 a year, 25-5 total, 25-5 full. And he was on the franchise tag. So he had to play out the year to get to that. So you're taking a deal a year early, and you're right at where he is in terms of the, you know, kind of the three-year value, the average value. You're a little bit under him in your on-paper guarantees, but you're relatively close in what your actual earnings are going to be. You didn't have to play the extra year to chance that injury. And in theory, you get the three-year versus the four-year if you're that unicorn player who works out. I don't see where the negativity is on Nick Chubb's side. That's number one. The second thing is the negativity that's come on the Cleveland Browns side. And I think that's kind of an interesting question. There's a couple things. And I think the negativity on the Cleveland Browns side comes from this part of the equation where you look at this and you go, wait a minute, this is an analytics organization, right? That's been the thing with them for the last couple of seasons. This is an analytics organization. What are they doing? And, you know, being an analytics organization doesn't mean you don't do things like this. Look, Philadelphia is an analytics organization, and I think they do at times some crazy stuff with their contracts, right? You use the analytics to help with your decisions, but it doesn't mean that you can't kind of break from the norms as to why you're going to do stuff. Now, if you look at some of the things here, they didn't do anything that's like insane. You know, with the way that the contract itself breaks down, I don't think they did anything that's crazy with it. Crazy is, and it wasn't even necessarily crazy within the market at the time. Crazy was the Rams with Gurley. The Rams and Gurley was crazy. And that led to more crazy. All right. But in light of the Gurley deal, you can understand where the Johnson deal comes in. In light of the Johnson and the Gurley deal, you understand where the Zeke deal comes in. In light of the Zeke deal, you understand where the McCaffrey deal comes in. In light of where the market is, you understand where this deal comes in. So I don't think that this is like a sign that it's not true that they're following any kind of analytics conviction. I think this is just, you know, that this probably isn't going to be best for you for 4 years. Might not even be good for you for three. Who knows? You're hoping. You need it to be good for three. But, you know, I think what you're doing is you're trying to get ahead of what could be a problem in a locker room. You know, if you have somebody unhappy about their contract, you're trying to get ahead of a spot. You know, unfortunately, if he gets injured, you know, misses some time where you get a lot of stuff about how the Browns didn't take care of their player. Now he's hurt. So you're kind of getting ahead of all that stuff. You also have a player that you believe in, that you think is solid. And, you know, I don't fall in the completely in that category of running backs don't matter. I think as individual players, there are individual players who can matter up to a point. I think the question is, where is that point? If the Browns are a good team, they know for a fact that Nick Chubb runs well behind their offensive line. They know he's very good late in games, which helps them because I think there's more trust in that than there probably would be in Mayfield throwing the ball and, you know, closing out games. And I think they like the way that he meshes with Kareem Hunt. You know, I'm just picking out, you know, so Chubb missed four games last year. So if you look around those games, you know, just the numbers that he put up. So first 4 weeks of the year, 10 for 60, 22-124, 19-108, 6 for 43. When he comes back from the injury, 19-126, 21-14, 19-144. The game against the Titans, let's see, 18 for 80, 17 for 82 in a loss. And then the final three games of the year, 15 for 50, 11 for 28. That was a loss. And 14 for 108. So I think he probably slowed down a bit at the end of the year. But you look at those numbers, and to me, you know, those numbers are, you know, pretty decent. You know, I think those are that's pretty good, because your alternative, where you go again with the whatever, you just throw anyone in there approach, you know, Kareem Hunt in those games that he missed, that's 5, 6, 7, and 8, 20-72, 13-40, 18-76, 14-66. They do go 2-2 over that spread. I don't think you would look at Hunt, even though he's a pretty good player, you know, forget the other stuff there. Let's just talk about football with him. He doesn't give you that same dynamic for, you know, that role that they really use Chubb in, I think, where he's a valuable player. So I can understand why they look at this and say, we've got a good thing. Now the question is, how do you make it work financially? And I think that's kind of where what you get into with the aspect of the contract. So his cap number is basically unchanged this year. And I think the bigger thing for them is that you get some kind of cost certainty now with the deal. So basically next year, his cap number will be 5.2. If they had a franchise tag him, which probably was going to be a possibility, I think it would have been about 9.5, maybe 10. We have different numbers on the site. The numbers on the site, I don't think are accurate. I keep a secondary thing on my computers where I track the tag values. That one's telling me that the tag numbers on the running back should be about 9.5 or 9.6. And I think that's probably the accurate number. I can go back and do it manually and see, but I believe that's probably the case. So I think they probably looked at that and said, okay, you know what? We save ourselves a couple million dollars. And if we need to, that gives us the franchise tag at our disposal. If we need to use it on someone like a Jarvis Landry, I'm just seeing if there's anybody worthwhile. You know, if Njoku has an awesome season, you know, that gives you the ability to use that on him. I guess if Clowney has a fantastic year, is he a free agent? I think he's a free agent. You know, you'd have that ability to use there. And I think Landry's a free agent as well. Let's see. Yeah, I'm wrong on that. Jarvis Landry has one more year under contract after that. So basically, it would be Njoku or Clowney. It would give you the ability for that. You know, and so it gives you some certainty. It also gives you certainty with the way that your contracts are going to be structured for the next couple of years, you know, as you get into talks on a Baker Mayfield extension. You know, it's the cap number 3 years from now, if he gets there, which would be 14.2, I think. You know, 14.9 is certainly pretty high. But again, you at least have that planning in mind to where you can kind of take that into account. The question is, can you kind of deal with these numbers as time goes on? And I think that's kind of the interesting thing with it. But again, I don't think it impacts them long term enough to where it's going to hurt them. At the most, it's going to hurt you a year. That's it. You know, it's going to hurt you in the 2023 league year. And as of right now, this is without a quarterback under contract, the Browns have 95.1 million in cap space for that year. You're going to lose, you know, you have two rookie classes, you're going to have a Mayfield extension, but you'll probably be able to keep the cap number lower in that year. I think given the composition of their roster and the fact that they're probably going to walk away from Odell Beckham or Jarvis Landry or both after the season, you know, I think that they can deal with it because it's not a long-term deal. It's not going to kill them financially in the long term. And when it does start to become a little bit more of a killer in the long term, their salary cap setup should be better, you know, better to deal with it, better to absorb it. So, you know, I'd have a completely different take if this had like $45 million in guarantees and it was $15 million a year. It's not that. It's not that contract. So I don't think that this really makes a problem for them other than they probably have to get rid of one of the receivers, which I think they were probably going to have to do anyway. You know, even if this deal wasn't done, I don't think you were going to be able to keep both of those players. So I think basically what you fall into now is, all right, they have these players coming up. You know, right now it's the benefit of you've got a cheap left tackle, you've got a cheap corner. Now you can, I guess, question the value of the defensive backs they have. But, you know, they're not overspent in there at the moment. They have a moderate-priced quarterback starting next year. So not crazy numbers, but moderate numbers. They have expensive wide receivers, and they have a pretty expensive offensive line, not counting the left tackle. And obviously they have an incredibly expensive pass rusher. So, you know, I think you look at it and say, okay, they're all right at left tackle. They're okay in the secondary for the moment. They're probably going to be okay long-term at wide receiver, as long as they can get, you know, a younger guy, probably develop a little bit. And you're probably going to have to make some offensive line changes probably by 2023. You know, you're going to have to change the way that you kind of approach that stuff. So I think they probably just looked at this and said, you know what? This keeps a status quo for 21. It probably is cheaper for 22. And if we screwed up, we probably have the room in 2023 to take care of it. So I kind of think that was the decision matrix for Cleveland here into as to why they did the deal and why they valued this particular running back. Now, you know, it's always one of those things, you know, somebody gets hurt, you know, next man up, sometimes it doesn't happen. And, you know, sometimes chasing the running back for a long time, you know, is a bad idea. So you've got a young enough player that you do this with, and you probably will get productivity this year. You'll probably get some enough productivity next year and then see what happens. So I don't think it's bad for them in that regard. So the reason that I kind of wanted to bring that up a little bit less, though, was to jump in on an interesting Twitter discussion, I think, that came up this week, which was, does the salary cap matter? Some people might look at this and go, well, no, it really doesn't. If they can do this and they can do that, and the Saints can do all these things. And I just thought it was a really interesting discussion. And that was really the main thing I wanted to talk about. I won't talk about it as much since there was other things. The salary cap as it's designed doesn't do the stuff that the NFL claims it does. All right. Now, I can say that as someone who likes the salary cap. I obviously enjoy tracking the salary cap. I think it's important. I just don't think it's as important for some of the reasons people bring up when it comes to it. You know, the concept that the salary cap is what brings parity to the NFL, I think is just really, really mistaken. The salary cap brings cost restrictions to the NFL. It brings cost certainty to the NFL. It does not in any way, shape, or form influence the results for teams over a short or long period of time, at least for the majority of football teams. Now, if you look back and you say, well, the selling point of the salary cap back in, you know, 93, 94 was that it was supposed to provide a system that let every team feel as if they could compete and constantly be having, you know, a lot of teams make the playoffs. It basically, that was the design for it. And if you look at the early days of the salary cap and the early days of free agency, because that's what happened in that period, it worked. You did see a little bit less dominance. You know, you didn't have the, for the most part, the 49er dynasties, the Cowboy dynasties, the Steeler dynasties. You know, what you saw were teams could become a dynasty through drafts like Dallas and San Francisco in the early 90s, then get torn apart by the salary cap. You couldn't stay good. So that was something that happened early on, and it worked. More teams made the playoffs, all that stuff. By the new CBA, by the time the new CBA came around, that completely turned opposite. All right. Your dominant teams were more dominant now than they were in the 70s and the 80s. And this is with more opportunities to win divisions because you have less teams competing for a division championship. Less teams make the playoffs, not more teams. Yeah. Are there changes every year? Sure, there's changes every year, but a lot of times those changes are kind of like wild card level teams and, you know, teams that aren't pushing forward a lot of times. And maybe they do jump in, jump out. So it's not creating this system where you're magically letting bad teams get better and you're keeping good teams from staying great. The things that create parity in the NFL, number one is the draft, because the draft gives every single team the same access to talent every year. And if you're a bad team, in theory, you have access to better players. And the way that you maneuver the draft gives you the best options to maximize your roster. So that's something that really brings parity to the league. you know, or at least keeps teams, you know, somewhat competitive, somewhat balanced. The franchise tag is a complete block on free agency. So you can block your best players from ever having a chance to leave. The threat of the franchise tag goes much further than just the tag itself. The threat of the franchise tag prevents players from even thinking they can get to free agency. You know, one of the reasons that I'm sure Josh Allen did this deal that he did this past week is because what's the alternative for Josh Allen? Well, the alternative is I'm going to play in 21, then I'm going to have to play in 22, then they're going to tag me in 23, they're going to tag me in 24, so I got to wait until 25? I'm just going to do the deal now. You know, and that's the factor at every position, because now you've extended your quarterback, so now your tag is available for your wide receiver. So now your wide receiver goes, God, I'm going to have to play, you know, this year out, then I'm going to have to play next 2 years on the tag. I don't know how good I'm going to be. I'm going to be 29 years old. Am I going to get a big contract? Probably not. So you're better off getting the big contract now. Now you're available for a cornerback. Same thing. So you extend the cornerback. So you're probably more your pass rusher than your corner. But you basically, this system that's put in place prevents the salary cap from really being even that much of an issue most of the time. You know, if you're looking to retain talent, the salary cap was designed back in like 1993 with a very different league in mind than the league that exists today. The league that existed then was old. Now, I don't mean all the players were, you know, 35, 38, 40, but the league was much older. The coaches preferred veteran known talent to unknown rookies. The teams much preferred star players, even as they were declining, than they did unknowns, unless it was like a top 10 pick. There's a reason why in that Jimmy Johnson chart, those top picks are like a gold standard and the rest is looked at as garbage. There's a reason for it, because the belief at the time was that the players coming into the draft, you know, it was really important at the top, not so important as you went down. You wanted to focus on veterans. The fear back then was that you were going to have all these stars hit free agency and it was going to completely change the game. And for a period it did. You know, Reggie White goes and leaves, and, you know, all these players leave and they go to different teams and they find success. Now, some of those players are the true superstars, they're true Hall of Famers that were able to have incredibly productive careers for many years. You had other players who looked like they were being productive simply because other teams were still focusing, I think, a lot on older talent. So even though your player was declining, he was playing against groups of players who were also declining. And I think over time, what happened is you started to see the teams that weren't able to sign players because of salary cap stuff or other issues or whatever, having to focus more on building younger teams. And you started to realize, wait a minute, the draft is really productive in rounds 1, 2, and 3. And it's kind of productive in 4, 5, 6, and 7. So it was a completely different league. And what it was designed to do was to prevent all these players from being able to go into free agency and basically have teams like the Dallas Cowboys or the New York Giants, you know, these big market teams just go crazy signing players. You kind of try to put this system in to kind of keep that little bit of a level playing field. From a financial standpoint, all these teams are worth a lot of money. All these teams share the national revenues. The only differences are your local revenues, which, don't get me wrong, is a big part of the equation. You know, Dallas is going to make more than Cincinnati, a lot more. But it's not so much of a playing field that you can't go in there and get it. But the other thing is that you don't see good players go into free agency. You just don't. It's second tier guys. So even when you build up all this cap space, like the Jets have done so many times in the last couple of years, you don't get better because you're just buying B-level talent. And the B-level talent is usually good for a season. Oftentimes, it's not good at all. So really, in my mind, the salary cap is more for teams that are mismanaged. It kind of becomes a crutch, but it's not a crutch for the league in general. It just doesn't work that way. I don't think teams lose players because of the cap anymore. I think there are teams that can't sign players because of the cap. All right, the Saints have been in that category. The Eagles have been in that category. There's plenty of teams that have been in that category because of the way that they've managed their salary cap. It's probably prevented you from signing some players, but not the players that you really want. It just has kind of kept you from adding those couple of other little pieces to the team that might make you better. But it doesn't change the fortune of a franchise. When my quarterbacks are Geno Smith and Ryan Fitzpatrick and Josh McCown and Sam Darnold and Luke Falk or whomever they trotted out there last year for those couple of games, or was that 2 years ago? I don't even remember. I'm so beaten down. You couldn't get better in free agency. You couldn't get better, you know, if you couldn't draft a quarterback. And that's the thing. So I don't think that the salary cap itself does anything to allow teams to get better and to prevent teams from becoming great. It just presents a different set of challenges. That's all. And most teams have figured out how to game it. You know, again, it's very different. You don't have the coach GM saying, get it done. You put yourself in a bad salary cap position. Okay, that does happen from time to time. Atlanta, clearly hurt by the salary cap. The Saints, clearly hurt by the salary cap. Steelers, clearly hurt by the salary cap. Okay, so yeah, it happens that you can hurt yourself. But for the most part, teams have people working in football administration that handle the contract side of things, and that's all they do. And they have a very good handle, as the league does in general, as to what is the life cycle of a player. You know, how long do you really want to be invested in the player for? You know, how much can you afford to spend? You know, so it doesn't really hurt you long term. The final thing is that in 2011, when the league put in the rookie rules, the league took the dumbness out of the room. That's what the league did. The reason the league did that wasn't so much because every rookie was getting too much money and every rookie was going to be Sam Bradford. Look, 50% of the rookies were probably Sam Bradford. 50% of the rookies were great. You know, you weren't overpaying Calvin Johnson. You didn't overpay Sue, right? Those are great players. You didn't overpay Peyton Manning. Hell, you didn't really even overpay Eli Manning. Those rookie deals were still relatively cheap if the player was a good player. The problem was you often had busts that were still getting paid like a top 10 player. And you would see deals that came down because the slots were only there for the first year and everything could be manipulated. You saw deals jump all over the place. When you had bad general managers, when you had even good general managers that were just way too bullish on a draft pick. But when you had bad general managers and you had owners that would get involved with that kind of stuff, it changed things for everyone. Look, Al Davis is a historic figure in the history of the NFL. Historic. The game had long passed Al Davis by in the salary cap era. They used to do insanity, especially on the rookie deals. And they still followed that old philosophy, sign a bunch of older players. That's why they got so bad. But they would do crazy stuff in some of those rookie deals. So you took the Al Davises out of the room. You said, we can't have this happen. We can't have what five crazy franchises are doing ruin this for all the other teams. So they put in this kind of scale that basically said, all right, we're never going to let you get bullied by an agent. We're never going to let the coach force this deal to happen. We're never going to let a bad general manager or an overbearing owner or whatever it is come in here and upset the salary scale. Never going to let it happen again. And once they did that, it completely took the salary cap out of play for a lot of teams, because a lot of the problems that were created from the salary cap that could help you create parity, meaning those players who you would be extending, you maybe couldn't do because of cap consequences, you know, and you might see grade A players get to free agency, or at least A minus players versus B level players. The reason for it was because of the screw-ups that were being done at the rookie level. And the rookie level screw-ups were causing you to screw up the rest of your roster. So, you know, I think that is really where the salary cap stopped being as meaningful. Now, again, if you're poorly run, yeah, it's meaningful. You're going to get blocked from being able to do stuff in certain years. But you also have figured out ways to get out from the cap hell much faster. In the past, you'd have teams that were just stuck in cap hell year after year after year. Now you don't see that often.
usually you can just take your lumps for a season and then you're back competing. You know, I think those are all big things. And, you know, the other thing is really the quarterback stuff, where the quarterbacks have so much control in a sense that once you have a decent quarterback, the prices skyrocket. Doesn't matter if the player is great or not great. They all end up kind of in the same little quadrant. So it's very difficult, especially with most on four-year deals now, Josh Allen and Patrick Mahomes notwithstanding. It's very hard where you're talking about short-term deals, you know, being able to ever get a benefit out of those contracts from players who maybe are like substandard level players. You know, if you look at like a Carson Wentz, now he had a bad fall. Maybe Goff is the better example, though Goff's fall was not great either. You know, I think if you had those guys on six-year deals, you might be able to look at that and say, okay, we've got these guys at like 32 or 33 million. It doesn't look good right now. You know, it's looking bad for us. There's only a couple players who earn more. But if you had them on six-year contracts, to where you might be able to look at something in the future and say, okay, you know, if we can get past this one, you know, 2-3 years from now, you know, we can really start to fill up the team with more players around them because we're going to actually have an advantage compared to other teams. You know, the Raiders should be in that situation right now with a player like Carr. They just haven't been able to kind of figure out how to do it. You know, you might be able to create something, but instead you're always kind of keeping up on the salary scale. You know, I just don't think the salary cap is that kind of deterrent to being great for a long period of time. Nor is it any kind of magic cure for success, even if it didn't exist, to where every year you could go in there and sign these players. Because, I mean, eventually you run out of money to spend. You know, there's a reason why owners want to keep salaries down. You know, they do have budgets. Budgets might be more than other teams, but most teams have a budget. And you're always going to have to work within that budget, salary cap or no salary cap. So, you know, I just don't. I kind of go on the side with this one that the impact itself of the salary cap is actually kind of overblown just because of the things that go into making a team great don't have anything to do with the cap anymore. You know, now again, it'd be different if players became free agents after 2 years. If players became free agents after 2 years, you'd have a completely different equation because you would have, not only would you have A-level talent getting into free agency, but you would have salaries jumping up, so the salary cap would become more of a factor. You would have access, even the B-level players are good players, and if you're getting them in year 3 instead of getting them in year 5 or year 6, well, now you're talking about getting players who can be productive for you for 3 or 4 years versus 1. You could change things that way, but the way everything is designed and the way the league has gone with the focus on younger talent and basically just throwing out the older players pretty quickly, creating a bunch of cap room, not having a bunch of cap room, doesn't change anything unless you screw it up. You know, if you screw it up, you know, to where you're the Falcons, where you say, and it's pretty much an honest assessment, we had to trade Julio Jones because of the salary cap. Okay, yeah, that mattered there. But that's because they screwed it up, not because of the salary cap itself. So I think it's more there as a block for screw-ups than it really is any kind of way to get teams more competitive with the better-run franchises in the NFL. You know, and there are edges to exploit with everything when it comes to the contracts and everything else. And I think it's interesting to see the possibilities that might exist. But in terms of the salary cap itself being something, this is a completely different NFL than 94 to 2010. It's a completely different NFL than that, and it's completely different rules than what you saw in the old CBA. So it's a completely different thing, and I think that that's one of the issues with looking at the cap and looking at it as like a big chance to get better. All right, let's take a look at questions for this week. So I'm pretty sure on email I just had one. This is from Tristan. Your latest article on pushing the cap forward, could you please clarify the data a bit more? How much of this is cap management? How much of this is QB and star player payments pushed in the future? I notice there's a great discrepancy between teams on how many players are being paid. Perhaps just run the numbers without QBs. So if you go to OTC and you check the article that I did, basically what we looked at were how much teams pushed in the future using signing bonuses this year. You know, they used a certain teams used a great deal. I talked about that a little bit last week, but I had just looked primarily at restructure bonuses. So this is more on, you know, just overall salaries. So I think the top team, I don't have it up on OTC. Let me see. The top team was the Cowboys at 77.7. Saints 73.4, Bucks 72.5, and Eagles 59.3. So if we ran that without the quarterbacks in there, let me see if I have them, if I have that up here or not where I can do that. Let me see if I can quickly put that in the proper format. Okay, so if we took the quarterbacks out from the numbers, the Saints would have pushed 64.2, Patriots 57.5, Eagles 57.4, Ravens 54, and the Rams 54, and the football team would be 53.45. And then on the low scale would still be the Jets, Dolphins. The Falcons would only be at 8.7 because you'd have Matt Ryan out of it. Raiders still at 11.7, Colts at 12. You know, it changes it somewhat. But basically it was just a question on cap management, more of like how do teams approach their salary cap structures. And that's why I want to look at contracts that were signed this year as well, where you kind of get the idea of, you know, are they a team that's looking more at the future, you know, looking to kind of go cash and cap kind of hand in hand? Jets, Dolphins clearly did that. Falcons did it because they had to. Raiders do it that way. Colts have done it that way. Chargers have been doing it that way too, versus the other method, which is sign as many players as possible by deferring cap charges to the future. You know, the Buccaneers did that this year. So that was really more the point of it than anything else. All right, let's take a look at Twitter here for questions. And I'm sorry if I missed anybody else's email. Did not mean to do that. All right, so Flip asks here, can you lay out a Watt contract that the Steelers would give and then how other teams would do it? So TJ Watt's not practicing right now. He's hoping for a new deal. You know, that's a tricky one. And my opinion is that if you go to the negotiating table with the Steelers, you know for a fact that you're doing a deal that's not going to have to be guaranteed. You just know that. Same thing with Green Bay and same thing with Cincinnati. If you're looking at how the Steelers would typically do that kind of deal, you know, I think he obviously, I don't know where, I think it was John Clayton. Yeah, John Clayton had a report that they were talking about a deal that would be like, I don't know, it was a ridiculous number, like 22, 23 million a year or something like that. I don't see that at all. You know, I think basically what you'd be doing is you're looking at a contract that's probably $29 million a year. And, you know, I think the main difference there is that the Steelers would give a pretty large signing bonus. Let me just see. How much did they give Antonio Brown? So the Steelers gave him 19. Bosa's signing bonus is 35. So I'm going to guess the Steelers would have to give a signing bonus probably around 40 million. You know, that's probably some magic number. Let me see. Is there anyone else that got a bonus anywhere close to that? Donald, maybe? Yeah, Donald's at 40. So my guess is they would have to go to 42 million actually looking at that. This way you hype that up as it's the biggest signing bonus in the history of the NFL for a defensive player. I'm assuming beating Donald gets you there. Basically what the Steelers would do is they would give him, you know, $42 million signing bonus, a very low paragraph five this year, you know, whatever the minimum is, you know, in his fifth year, 990, I think would be the number for that, to give him a minimum. Then next year, what they would do is they would give him a non-guaranteed roster bonus. I'm not exactly sure how much, but they'd have a roster bonus in there and a moderate paragraph five. And that's typically the way they would do it. That's the way the Packers do it. That's the way the Bengals would do it. They all kind of fall in the same category. The other teams, what they would do is they probably might not give as much of a signing bonus. They might, you know, certainly in the 30s, probably, I guess, depending on their approach. But what would basically happen is, you know, they would have loads and loads and loads of guarantees in there. So
the only thing that he would get guaranteed from the Steelers is that $42 million. Even though you know from the fact that it's a $42 million signing bonus, he's not getting cut next year. So his 920 this or 990 this year would be protected. His salary next year would be protected. His roster bonus the following year would be protected. All that stuff would be protected. You know, his 3-year number would probably end up very similar to Bosa's, you know, probably close to 90. And all that would basically be protected, even if it's not on a piece of paper. But you would probably be looking at, you know, for other teams, probably $105 million guaranteed, maybe 110, 80 to 85 fully guaranteed would be the kind of numbers you'd be talking about. And he's not going to get any of those. So that's basically the difference. Also, you asked about DeCastro last week and him filing a grievance due to the way he was released. Is there an expiration date? I forget what the timeline is. Usually there is a timeline for you to file a grievance, but sometimes the actual filing of a grievance and somebody reporting on it is a pretty big period of time. So I really don't know. The team does have to hold back 40% of the contract once the grievance is filed. So teams usually just plan for certain situations that a grievance will be filed, make sure they have that salary cap money held back there. Let's see. What are your findings? Sorry, just got a text real quick. So Proud Black Bat says, what are your findings on investing in the secondary versus the defensive line? Would be interesting to see if one group is better to spend draft capital and one is better to spend cap space on. Example, Ravens versus 49ers. You know, that's a pretty interesting one. And we'll make that a bigger topic. So I can actually pull some numbers to kind of to back that up. We'll look at teams that have had success with veteran spending versus teams with non-veteran spending. So versus draft, just draft implications. So let me circle back on that one. Let's make that a topic maybe next week. Maybe I'll even write an article or something on it, because that's kind of an interesting, a little interesting approach to do with that. My gut feeling is that teams that spend on extensions, probably with the pass rushers, I'm going to say do better only because I think the teams that invest in one player on the secondary might not invest in the whole market on it, but that's just a very quick, you know, off the top of my head thought. So let's run a bunch of numbers on that one and actually do a little bit more nuanced discussion on that in the future. Jeff said, what if an unvaxxed player gets so sick that he's not cleared to play next year? Does the contract get told? Does he get paid while sipping oxygen in the hospital? Can they cut him? Grim question, not illegitimate. I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure what the rules actually, I haven't followed the rules on COVID as much this year. I'm not as interested in it. I don't care. I think at this point, not that you can just make it go away, but I think everybody should just be doing their part to make it go away. Even if you don't believe that it's anything more than just the flu, and that's fine. If that's what your belief is, I don't have a problem with people's different beliefs. The fact is, it is what it is. You know, and if you're looking for things to change and you're looking for regulations to change, you know, everybody should do their part. That's just kind of my opinion on it. You know, I'm not really sure on that. I would guess if he's not, okay, so if he's not cleared to play next year as well, the player would definitely get cut. That's number one. I guess the other possibility was you'd throw him on NFI, which, yeah, if you put him on NFI, if it was the last year of the contract, it would toll. Otherwise, it probably wouldn't. But they may have specific rules for that. But for this year itself, if you missed a whole season, I'm not sure how that would really work. But I don't think anything would carry over to next year. I would think it would be the same as like an injury. The Jets haven't signed anyone to a long-term contract that has panned out in years, with May not able to get a deal done. Who's the next player you think he extends? I'm not sure who the next one is that he's going to extend, but the first major deal he's going to do is going to be Quinnen Williams. I think that's a given. You know, there may be a player before that who gets extended that maybe is not exactly a major player, you know, at least a major player up to that level. But I think Williams is the next one to look at. I'd be surprised if May gets signed next year. Is your belief Rodgers is more likely to be cut than traded based solely on Schefter's comments about him choosing his team, or are there cap implications? Prevailing thought in Rodgers' own comments indicate the opposite. It would really just be about cap implications that you would think that he was going to be cut versus traded. There are ways that you can manipulate the numbers so he could be traded, and they could deal with the cap charges on there as well. But it's really just has to do with that the team would at least consider cutting him. I don't think it has anything to, I don't think they would have anything else to do with them promising him
His possibility to choose his next team. There's not going to be any honor in giving him a release. Let's put it that way. There's, if they think there's a trade market and they can deal with the salary cap issues related to having him on the books on the first day of the league year without a restructure, they'll do it. Humbaba says, what are the chances of Allen turning into Wentz and when can the Bills cut him without significant costs? So there's really no point where it's not significant, but 2026, I think, is the year for that. I'd say 50-50. Now, maybe a little bit less than that, you know, him turning into Wentz. You know, he doesn't have the injury history of Wentz. He's more athletic than Wentz. And he's more physically talented and gifted. But, you know, it can happen to anybody. So I maybe 40% chance. You know, I don't think that it's a minor chance that he ends up not turning out to be, you know, as good as people think. You'll know this year. That's basically what you'll see. You'll find out this year. Brian says, it can't be bad for the Browns to never extend Baker, right? Keep him through his rookie deal, franchise him twice. So yeah, you can do that. There's nothing wrong with following that strategy, even from a team perspective, as long as you can deal with the potential fallout that's going to occur. The fallout meaning you may have fallout from within the team, you know, where people are going to say, wow, how can they not be extending the quarterback? You might have fallout with the player and his agent where they're going to be pressuring you like, why are you doing this to my guy? Like, you're talking about a top pick in the league. He's not a fourth round player like Dak Prescott. You know, he's not Kirk Cousins. What are you doing? You know, you might, and you're definitely going to get pressure from media, very intense pressure as to why they're not doing it. So, I mean, those are kind of off-field considerations that I think you have to take into account. You may also have to take into account if there's anyone else that coincides with him that you want to get done. I don't know if they really have anybody coming up that would fall into that category. But, you know, but I don't think it's – when you look at the money that quarterbacks get these days, I think if you don't have a real indication that the quarterback is the guy – there's nothing wrong with continuing to protect your rights for 3 years. Even though the numbers get ridiculously high, it might not even be as much as you would pay for 3 years of a quarterback under a new contract now. Might be. And, you know, you can't manage the cap hits. And when I say the cap doesn't matter as much, maybe it would if you followed a strategy like this, especially when you got to the third year. But I don't know. You know, I don't know if it's completely out of the realm of possibilities. The only thing I will say, and this goes back to the same stuff I said about Prescott a couple of years ago, if you're a team that thinks that, you have to start to protect yourself by looking in the first and second round to draft another quarterback. You have to have somebody else on the roster that you can evaluate during training camp if you are thinking there's a chance that you're not going to re-sign one of these guys. You can't franchise tag Baker Mayfield when you have nobody behind him but Case Keenum. It's like, oh, what's going to happen that year? How bad would Baker Mayfield have to be for you to be able to fall so far back that you could draft a quarterback the next year and say, okay, we're completely changing our plan up? So you have to be proactive in the way that you approach the quarterback position, and no team is, except for Green Bay. Every other team is proactive with it, or reactive, I mean. They wait until the quarterback sucks and then they go, oh, we need a quarterback. You know, really? You're figuring that out now? So I think if you're going to go down that approach, you need to be proactive with the way you approach your draft and maybe ruffle some feathers, but do that. GBNF, did the Aaron Rodgers get any more money to come back? No, he did not. I know he turned down a lucrative extension, but wondered if any part of his salary got changed to fully guaranteed. No, it's all basically same deal. Zach says, predictions for Lamar's next contract, does he go shorter like Dak or longer like Allen? Now, that's an interesting one. And where I say that every quarterback should be doing 4 year, 4 year, 4 year, or really they should be doing three, Lamar Jackson, I think, is an interesting case because his game is not built at all on passing the football. It's all based on really his athleticism, his running ability, his ability to throw on the run. I think he's a player where physically you could be afraid that there's a chance he breaks down. He might not, but there is more of a risk, I think, in a player like that having his body break down. And Allen's a runner too, but I think Allen is a better passer. And I think Allen could be successful without the running. I'm not sure if Lamar can or will be. But I mean, you look at someone like Michael Vick, you know, Michael Vick's body, he wasn't, now I know obviously he went to jail in between there. He was not the same player afterwards. I mean, maybe he had the 1 year in Philly where it was there, but he wasn't the same player after that. Cam Newton is not the same player anymore. Culpepper got hurt. Culpepper was a better passer anyway. You know, McNabb was, a better overall player. Steve Young, you know, he was a scrambler that, you know, really became a better overall player. I'm trying to think of other guys who kind of ran the ball a bit. And really, other than Vic, I'm not sure if anybody ran to this level and was that type of runner. So I think for him, doing a deal where you have kind of a lot of protection is pretty good. You know, I think if you were Lamar Jackson, it's not as bad of an idea if you did a longer deal. I'd want more injury protection than Josh Allen got, more full protection. I think you want a better guarantee package up front. And I think you still want a lot of that rolling guarantee protection that makes it hard for the team to release you, harder for the team to release you towards the end of the contract. I think that's a lot better protection for a player like him than some of the other guys. You know, maybe not. You know, maybe he's going to develop more in his passing game. But based on the way he plays, I would probably lean that way. WFT News. Sammy Reyes' relatively large contract make the likelihood of him being claimed off waivers less likely if cut. If he clears, it's my understanding that he's likely to sign for the practice squad. I don't even know what his deal is. I can't imagine that it's high enough for anybody to not claim it. So you'd be pulling on, you'd be having a guarantee of about $400K on that deal. I don't think that would make somebody not claim it. You know, you're going to get a large portion of that back through having a player on the practice squad. Cut him, you probably get a large portion of it back by him being on somebody else's practice squad. So no, I don't think that that's the contract would allow him to sneak through waivers. His going through waivers is going to be strictly based on how good or how not good he's looked. Lance Harper, I really enjoy the podcast. I was wondering, how did you get into the business? What has been the most surprising part of it? I don't really even consider myself part of anything. I'm just a guy who likes salary cap stuff. And that's really it. You know, I'm just somebody who really liked talking about this stuff, writing about it, discussing it mainly about the Jets, and just kind of took it to a different level. I think for me, the most surprising part of it is just how many people have utilized the site, not just speaking in general for fans of the NFL, but media, big writers, football executives, so many staff around the league, so many agents. Like that's been the more surprising part of it than anything else. I never really expected that with it. You know, I didn't expect that, you know, you'd see stuff for OTC on NFL Network every now and then, you know, where they'll pull certain numbers and, you know, we'll get the credit for where those numbers come from. You know, that's been the most surprising part, I think, with it. Lee says, how does the Ravens cap look in 2022? Lamar extension cut his 2022 cap hit in half. I don't think they're in a bad position. Let me just see. I'm not off the top of my head. I'm not really sure, but I think they were fine by then. You know, they were tight this year. They were tight last year, I think. You know, they have most of their big name guys other than the quarterback re-signed. Yeah, they're 30. You know, they're fine. You know, they're 30 next year without the QB under contract. So, I think their situation is probably decent. You know, it's probably not incredibly awesome, but I think it's decent. Are there any resources similar to your book, but for understanding Major League Baseball luxury tax and salary structure? No idea. I'm sure there's got to be something that exists, but I'm not sure of that at all. All right, let's see if there's anything else, and then we'll call this one a day. Can you take us back in time and not trade two firsts for a safety? Barring that, any thoughts on what's holding up Jamal Adams' extension? That's from Mark. I think Jamal Adams is looking for a ridiculous amount of money. I've said this before. I think he's a player that was looking to be the, you know, $20 million safety. So my thought is that's where his asking price would be. I think he probably feels, you know, corner got up to 20. And I've talked about this before. Corner and safety kind of went hand in hand for a while. and now we've seen corner go up and safety is flat. I think there's a good possibility that he's going to dig his heels in more, because when you start looking at the linebackers being over 19, he's going to say that I'm better than Fred Warner. I'm better than Darius Leonard. I can play linebacker. I can rush the passer, and I can cover as good as them. Debatable on the coverage, I'll tell you that right now. But you know, I think it's debatable that linebackers have that kind of impact on coverage as well. But I think that's the main reason. There is no way that Seattle can do a deal, number one, that's above Bobby Wagner. I've said that since they made the trade, that, you know, that was going to be his thing. The other thing is, it's very difficult, I think, to want to be able to set a precedent anywhere that you're going to value a player as being worth like $5 million more a year than the next closest player. If you have Justin Simmons at 15.25, your target, if you're the Seahawks, is probably 16, and certainly no more than 17. So I think you probably have a big disparity between what the two sides think. And just a gut feeling from the way a lot of things were handled with him with the Jets, I don't know if there's a lot of wiggle room on his end. You know, a lot of these negotiations, it's a give and a take for both sides. I don't know how much he's going to be willing to come down to get a deal done. So I think this one might end up being a headache for the whole year. But yeah, I mean, it's a problem. The trade was a problem. Not doing the extension at the time of trade was a problem. You understand why they traded for him, given where they were as a team. But I think right now it's all pretty much blowing up on them. So we'll see how it goes. You know, I say that a lot. We'll see how it goes. But I think he's just kind of the hard guy to deal with that kind of stuff. And I don't know when he's going to start practicing. I think he's doing like a hold-in kind of deal right now. You see what effort you get from the year, and you're going to franchise tag him, which is just going to make more issues. But the right way to play the situation out, if you're Seattle, if he's not going to budge on this, is you got to make him play this year and you got to tag him next year. That's just the way to do it. Whether that happens, whether you want to deal with that, I don't know. You know, if you can't, you trade him, you know, and just move him and let him be somebody else's contract headache. So anyway, that's it for me this week. So everybody have a great week. Next week we'll do that, and hopefully I'll get something together on the edge versus secondary spending. I think that might be just interesting to look at. I've been doing some positional spending stuff anyway, but I think that might be a unique approach. We'll look at rookie investment versus, you know, regular investments, and let's see how some of these teams did over that period of time. So I like that suggestion. Hopefully we can do that next week. If not, sometime in the future. I will mention this. I am going to be probably taking a week or two off from the podcast. We have a little bit of a family vacation coming up. So unless I do something from there, I think the way that our schedules work out is there might be a little bit of a gap, but I'll talk more about that next week. So everybody have a great week, and I will talk to you all again soon.